We break into a run. I lead him along the stilt walkways, over the jetty bridges, onto the mainland of the resort, and on through the puddle-gathering pathways, all the way out to the roaring Pacific coastline. We stumble on through the sand, the wind buffeting us from all sides now. Our clothes, dark and heavy with rain, cling to us as we scramble out towards the waves. We stop at the edge of the South Pacific Ocean. "Scream!" I shout. "What?" He stares at me. He can't hear me over the roar of the wind and sea. "Scream!" This time he hears me. He laughs. "What?" he shouts, incredulous. "Scream, Mark! Fucking scream!" I turn to the ocean, the wind, the pounding abyss beyond, and I scream. I scream with every fiber of my being. I scream for what's happening to Mark right now, for what happened to Alexa, for her dead mother, for mine, for Mark's future, for our future, for myself. I scream until I have no breath left. Mark looks at me, silent through the storm. I can't tell what he's thinking. He turns, seems to be about to walk away, but then he circles back and he screams, long and hard into the lashing rain and fog, every sinew poised, every muscle ready, a battle cry into the unknown. And the wind roars back. Chapter 12. Saturday, September the 10th. Things in the water. By dawn, the storm has passed. We wake in our suite to the usual gentle tapping of room service. The only evidence of the storm is the occasional loose palm frond floating past in the lagoon and our own hoarse voices. I haven't slept so well in years. After breakfast, Mark goes to have a chat with the hotel dive coordinator. Mark wants us to go diving this afternoon. He's going to see if we can go under our own steam. He and the dive coordinator seemed to hit it off pretty well yesterday, so I leave Mark to it and stay behind. I promise Mark I won't do any work, but the moment he's out of the door, I've got my laptop open. There are emails from everyone. Wedding stuff, mostly, but I'm looking for work emails, news about the project. I find one. Holloway Prison has emailed about Holly. There are new details about her release date. It's been moved forward. It's now set for September the 12th, 2 days from today. Damn, it wasn't supposed to be until we were back. I fire off a couple of emails to Phil, my cameraman, and Duncan, the sound guy. We'll need to go to Holly's house to interview her as soon as I'm back. It's not ideal, but we need the footage as fast as we can get it after she's out. I also remind them of our Alexa release filming dates. She'll be getting out a couple of days after I get back, so there's a little more prep time on that. Another email catches my eye. It's from Pentonville Prison this time. Eddie's release date is set. My interview with him is penciled in for 1 week after we return. And then there's a knock on the door. Odd. Mark has a key. Why is he knocking? He's up to something. I smile to myself as I head for the door and pull it open dramatically. A tiny Polynesian woman stands in the doorway smiling. "Special gift. You take." She beams up at me and proffers a misted ice bucket containing a bottle of very expensive-looking chilled champagne. "Oh, no, sorry, we didn't order..." I begin, but she shakes her tiny, crinkly head slyly. "No. Special gift. Gift from friend. Marriage gift." "Yes." She grins. "Well, that does make sense, I suppose. A gift from Fred and Nancy, or Caro, maybe?" She nods at me to take it, and for some reason I bow slightly as I take the bucket from her. Some unconscious nod to cultural respect, I suppose. I really shouldn't be allowed out of the house sometimes. She giggles merrily and waves her little hand, and wanders back toward the hotel. Inside the room, I place the bucket carefully on the glass coffee table. Beads of condensation drip down its sides. There's a note. I open up the thick card and read. "To Mrs. Erin Roberts. Congratulations on your nuptials, sweetheart. took the liberty of sending you a little gift. A nice Dom Perignon 2006. Used to be the wife's favorite. God knows we've had our differences over the years, but she's got taste. I'll give her that. After all, she married me. Anyway, I wish the best for you both now and in the future. Make sure he treats you right. Enjoy yourself, sweetheart. Oh, and apologies for the call the other week. I wasn't able to speak freely at the time, but we'll talk again very soon. I heard they've set my release date, so we're all set. Looking forward to meeting you in 2 weeks. I won't waste any more of your time now. Get back out in that lovely sunshine. Best wishes, Eddie Bishop. Dom Perignon 2006. How the hell did he do that? He knows exactly where I am, what island I'm on, what room we're in, everything. But then I already knew he was keeping tabs on me, didn't I? But this is creepy. If I think it through logically, what does it mean? It means Eddie found out where we were staying and phoned the hotel to order us a bottle. They could have found out anywhere. It wasn't as if I was keeping our honeymoon destination a secret. Anyone interested could have figured it out without too much trouble. In a way, it's kind of sweet, isn't it? Or is it meant to be a threat? Whatever Eddie's intention, benign or malevolent, I decide not to tell Mark. He'd only worry. I hear footsteps along the walkway outside and pop the card into my pocket. I'll get rid of it later. I grab my laptop off the sofa where I left it just as Mark enters. I'm caught out. He smiles. You're working, aren't you? I shrug, non-committal, and slip the laptop into a drawer. Nope. Mark's arranged a boat and diving gear for this afternoon. It'll be ready for us on the dock after lunch. Apparently, the storm has made underwater visibility around the island quite bad, so the hotel dive instructor, Mark's new best friend, has given him the GPS coordinates of a great wreck a bit further away. The visibility should be good out there. It's near an island about an hour out by motorboat. Mark's got a skipper's license from a gap year crewing yachts in the Mediterranean, so it shouldn't be too difficult for him to get us there. The hotel has even suggested we take a picnic and moor around the island after our dive. It's uninhabited, so we won't need to worry about disturbing anyone. I'm pretty excited. A desert island to ourselves. The trip out is slightly unnerving in the sense that once Bora Bora disappears from sight, there is nothing else. Nothing in any direction but blue. I now understand how sailors used to go mad at sea. It's like snow blindness. If it weren't for the dot on the GPS moving steadily towards the destination pin, I'd swear we were going around endlessly in giant looping circles. An hour out, we see the island we're heading towards breaching the waves on the far horizon ahead, which means it's about 3 miles away. The horizon is always approximately 3 miles away from you when viewed at sea level. Good to know, isn't it? The wreck we're after today is just northwest of the island. It's a depth of only 20 meters, which Mark promises I'll be fine with. Technically, you're not supposed to go below 18 meters, so we'll be sticking around 20 meters on this holiday, okay? Trust me, honey, you won't automatically explode if you go 2 meters over your max today. The limit's only meant to be a guideline, really. 20 meters will be absolutely fine, and I'll be right there with you, okay? He reassures me. I know he's certified to go down to twice that depth. A pink, sun-bleached buoy bobbing in the waves marks the wreck site. We drop anchor a safe distance away. As we're suiting up, Mark glances over at me, a shadow crossing his face. Erin, honey, just want to give you a heads up. There is supposed to be a lot of sharks out here, sweetheart. I literally stop breathing. He laughs at my expression. It's fine. I'm going to be completely honest, okay? I'm going to tell you exactly what's in there, honey, so you know. All right? I nod. I couldn't speak if I wanted to. He continues. You know those black-tipped sharks they've got in the lagoon, right? The ones we saw the other day. I nod. He goes on, his voice smooth and reassuring. The black tip sharks, you're fine with them. They're perfectly friendly, aren't they? They don't bite people, and they're not that big, relatively speaking. They're only the same size as a person, so not the biggest shark, but then again, they're definitely not fish-sized anymore. They're fine, though. You with me so far, Aaron? I nod again. When I first saw a black tip shark in the lagoon on Monday, while we were snorkeling, I almost had an aneurysm. They look absolutely terrifying. But he's right. After the initial shock, I was fine with them. They didn't bother us at all. Well, there'll be lots of them, he continues. Great. And there might be quite a lot of lemon sharks too. Lemon sharks are around 3.5 meters long. That's about the length of a hatchback car. They don't tend to hurt people, but they are 3.5 meters long, just so you're aware. Wow, okay, they're big. They're fine, Aaron, trust me. But just to be on the safe side, they don't like anything shiny, like watches, jewelry, that kind of thing, so I hastily remove both my rings and thrust them at him. What else is there, Mark? I brace myself. He takes the rings. There's a chance that there might be grey reef sharks. 2 meters. Fine. White tip sharks, silver tips, 3 meters. Fine. And stingray, maybe. Fine too. They're like the manta rays in the lagoon, but smaller. And turtles, he continues. Lovely. Love them. And maybe, but probably not. And you know, even if we do see them, then don't worry, they'll keep their distance, it'll be fine. But there might be tiger sharks. Oh my God. Even I know about these. These are real sharks. Big sharks. 4 to 5 meters long. I'm really not sure about this dive now. I look at Mark. He looks at me. Just the sound of lapping waves against the boat's hull. He laughs. Aaron, do you trust me? Yes, I say reluctantly. They might come towards you, but they will not hurt you, okay? He holds my gaze. Okay, I nod. Okay, just breathe. That's all you need to do, I tell myself. Breathe. It's just like the pool. It'll be just like the pool. We finish suiting up and slip into the water. It's nice buddy checking with Mark again. Safe. Plus he's pretty easy on the eyes. He holds my look. Are you okay? I nod. I'm okay. Then we slip beneath the water. We descend slowly. My eyes are glued to Mark. I follow every hand signal, every move. And then he points. And I see it. I could glimpse the wreck through the water from up in the boat, but now that we're under the waves, I can see it crystal clear ahead of us. We descend. As my eyes adjust to the light, I start to notice fish darting about our bubbles as they rise back to the surface. I follow a parting fish with my eyes and see it join a shoal under the shadow of the speedboat, a column of twisting and turning silver. I look back to Mark. He's controlling our descent. Nice and slow. No sudden moves. He's looking after me, his face angled down at his wrist computer, his expression one of intense concentration. We hit 5 meters and pause for a check. Mark signals okay. Okay, I signal. We're doing fine. He signals to continue the descent. He's doing this so completely by the book that I can't help grinning behind my regulator mouthpiece. I'm in good hands. I look down and see coral on some rocky outcrops a good 5 meters below us. I look back up. The surface is nearly 10 meters away now, dancing brightly above us. I look to Mark, suspended in blue, outside of time. He looks to me and smiles. We sink. A movement in my periphery view. Not an object, but a change in color depth just beyond my field of vision. I turn my head and focus hard into the blurred blue beyond us, straining my eyes to see through the shaded water. Then I see them. They're all around us. They come into focus, one by one. With each, my heart skips a beat. The fizz of adrenaline shoots through my veins. The water is full of them. Arcing in great loops over the wreck and out around the reef, their hulking bodies hanging weightlessly in the blue-green air around us. Fins, gills, mouths, teeth, gliding like ocean liners. Sharks. So many sharks. What type they are doesn't seem relevant to my central nervous system, which has taken over. I'm not breathing. My muscles are frozen, like that nightmare where you can't scream. I look to Mark. His eyes are flickering over them fast. He's assessing the threat. I manage to lift my hand. Terrified the movement will draw their attention. I signal, okay? My forearm trembling beyond my control. Mark lifts a hand. Wait. His eyes scanning the waters around us. I look up, 15 meters up. Breathe, Erin, fucking breathe. I draw in deep, cool, crisp tank air. Exhale slow and calm. I watch my bubbles escape to the surface. Good. Good work, Erin. Mark turns to me in the water. Okay. It's okay. He smiles. My whole body relaxes. They're all fine. We're fine. I look out to them. It's vaguely reminiscent of wandering into a field full of cattle. The size, the vague worry that they might at any instant turn on you, come at you. Then I notice their fins. The fin tips aren't black or silver or anything. They are grey. The perspective is hard to judge. I can't tell how far away they are. But they're big. They're really big. Grey reef sharks. They know we're here. They can see us. But it will be okay. They won't come for us. They won't attack. It's okay. We continue our descent. We pass a huge school of yellow and silver fish, 6 feet high and densely packed. When we reach the bottom, Mark signals to follow him towards the wreck. It's not too far ahead of us now along the ocean floor. It comes out of the haze and into sharper focus as we fin towards it. I look up at the school of fish and the sharks above us. A wall of fish, a cathedral wall of fish, suspended in the clear water above us. Wow. I look over to Mark. He sees it too. Without a word, he reaches through the water and takes my gloved hand in his. After the dive, we lunch on the empty island, bringing the boat as close to shore as we can. We peel off our suits and swim naked in the shallows, sunbathe on the empty sand. It's getting late by the time we climb back on the boat and set off towards Bora Bora. Mark stands over the wheel, gaze focused on the middle distance. It might take us longer than an hour to get back to the hotel at this time of day. The wind whipping my hair over my eyes, coupled with my exhausted limbs, makes it almost impossible to stay awake as we bump along the waves. The flashing green circle on the GPS creeps towards the red one. My eyelids begin to droop. I'm not sure if I dozed off, but when I open my eyes, the speedboat motor is changing tone, and we're slowing. I look up at Mark. We're not back in Bora Bora yet. There's nothing there. Just ocean stretching miles in every direction. And then I see what he sees. In the water, all around us, paper. Sheets of white paper. We're approaching their source. A circle of papers about 10 meters wide. I can't tell what they were. Magazines, forms, or documents, because the ink has run across the pages, dark and illegible now. The papers stick to the surface of the waves like a film of skin. Mark glances at me. What is this? We can see to the horizon on all sides. Nothing but blue. Garbage, maybe? We stop in its center. Our boat is in the eye of a giant circle of floating papers. Mark cuts the engine. In its way, it's beautiful. Like a modern art installation floating in the middle of the South Pacific. I reach over the side of the boat and fish out a wet page from the water. The writing dissolves before my eyes as I lift it towards me, the ink running and swirling across the wet white. Who knows what it said? It can't have been that important, though, to end up here. Can it? Maybe it was the storm that brought it here. I study the swirls of illegible black across the white pages. If it was important, it's not now. Mark and I share a glance, the silence thick around us. It's eerie. Suddenly I have this crazy idea that we died. Maybe we died and this is purgatory. Or a dream. The silence is broken by a thunk against the side of the boat. And another thunk, thunk. The waves are knocking something repeatedly into the side of the hull. We look towards the noise. Whatever it is, we can't see it over the rim. Thunk. Thunk. Mark frowns at me. I shrug. I don't know. I don't know what it is either. But there's something in his demeanor, something in the set of his shoulders, that makes my blood freeze. Something bad is happening. Mark thinks something very bad is happening. Thunk. Thunk. Insistent now. Thunk. Thunk. Mark steps towards the noise. Thunk. Thunk. He braces himself against the boat, arms spread. Then he inhales sharply and leans over the side. He doesn't move now. Thunk. Thunk. He's looking down at whatever it is. Frozen. Thunk. Thunk. And then he shifts, and he ever so carefully lowers a hand overboard. It disappears from view, thunk, thunk. With a grunt, Mark heaves a waterlogged object onto the deck between us. It lands with a wet suck on the floor. A few bits of soggy paper stick to it. We stand and stare at it. It's a black canvas duffel bag, just under a meter in length. It's too big for a gym bag, but too small for a holiday suitcase. It's clearly good quality, but there don't seem to be any labels, no writing. Mark bends to inspect it, no tag, no handy address label. He looks for a zip, hidden black on black, and finds it. The zip is padlocked to the fastening of the bag by a matte black combination lock. Huh. Okay. Obviously valuable. It's obviously not garbage, right? Mark glances up at me. Should he try and open it? I nod. He tries to force the zipper, padlock and all. It won't budge. He tries again. He looks up. I shrug. I want to open it too, but... He tries the fabric around the zip, pulls at it. It doesn't give way. He partially lifts the bag as he wrestles with it, the wet fabric smacking against the fiberglass deck as he struggles. The bag has things in it. I can make out hard, angular shapes moving round inside as Mark tries to force a way in. He stops abruptly. Maybe we should wait, Mark says. His voice is taut, concerned. Whoever owns it definitely doesn't want anyone getting into it, right? I guess not. But the allure of finding out what's inside is pretty fucking strong right now. He's right, though. He's definitely right. It's not ours to open, is it? I gesture towards it. I just want to hold it, feel it. Maybe I'll know what's in it by weight, by shape, like a Christmas present. Sure, go ahead. He stands back, giving me room. It's heavier than it looks, he adds just as I lift the handles, and it is deceptively heavy, I pick it up slowly and it hangs around my calves, wet and weighted.
I drop it immediately and it hits the fiberglass with a familiar thunk.
Mark stares at me, shakes his head. It's not. He knows what I'm thinking.
It's not, Erin. They'd have eaten it. They'd have smelled it and eaten it, especially the Greys. It's not.
He insists, but it's the way he says it. I know he was thinking it too. Of course he's right. If it was a body, the sharks would have had it by now. It's not organic. It's just some things in a bag. Probably just someone's business accounts or something, judging by all the paper around. Maybe some dodgy bookkeeping. Just accounting at the end of the day. I'm sure it's really not that interesting. Right? Just some stuff in a bag. In a padlocked bag, Erin. Floating in the middle of the South Pacific, surrounded by 10 meters of illegible papers. What should we do? I ask. Should we even do anything? Should we put it back in the water and just leave it? Mark looks at his watch. It's getting late now. The sun will be setting in the next half hour or so, and we've still got a 45-minute journey back. I do not want to be out in the middle of nowhere when it gets dark. Mark doesn't either.
We need to get going. I'll note the coordinates and we'll take the bag back with us, hand it in or something. Okay, Erin? We'll let someone know about this mess. Whatever happened here.
He finds a pad and pencil in a locker under the seat, jots down the location on the GPS. I look out across the water at the papers, searching for some other clue to what this strange situation could be. But there's just that familiar blue, all around. Nothing else bobbing in the water, nothing drifting on the waves. Just paper and blue. I turn back to Mark.
Yes, okay. We'll hand it in at the hotel and they can sort it out. I sit back down.
It's none of our business, really. Someone probably just dumped it.
Mark turns back to the wheel and we're off again, speeding back towards the hotel and dinner.
I watch the bag slide across the decking and lodge under a seat. I curl up on the bench cushions behind Mark and put on his sweater, pulling the sleeves down over my cold hands, hair whipping across my face. I close my eyes.
Chapter 13. Sunday, September the 11th. The day after. We bounce out of bed early this morning. All the exercise and fresh air is knocking us out by 10 most nights, and I feel great. We handed the bag in last night when we docked at the hotel. Mark gave it to a porter, and we explained that it had been found in the water. Mark didn't think it was worth telling the guy on the dock about the coordinates or the papers. Best to have a chat with the dive guy about it today instead. He seems a bit more on it, and he might actually look into it. We breakfast in the main restaurant today. It's the Four Seasons Sunday Buffet. It's ridiculously opulent. Everything you could ever want to eat. Whole lobsters, pancakes with syrup, exotic fruit, full English breakfast, sushi, rainbow cake. Ludicrous. That's another great thing about all this exercise. I can pretty much eat whatever I want right now, and it'll make no difference. We've got exciting plans for today. 4x4 off-roading in the forest on the main island, followed by a hike up Mount Otumanu to the sacred cave, then back to the hotel for the Sunday evening torch-lit dinner on the beach. The boat will be collecting us right after breakfast from the jetty. There's no sign of the dive guy yet, and I need to nip back to the room to quickly grab my bag and sunscreen, so I leave Mark at the restaurant and run back to our room. I don't see it at first. As I come out of our bathroom, toothbrush in my mouth, mid-stroke, there it is, sitting neatly on the floor at the end of our bed. The bag. Someone put it back in our room. It's dry now. Chalky salt tide marks cross the black canvas, padlock still safely fastened. They must have misunderstood what Mark was saying last night. And now it's back. I think of the thunk, thunk,
against the side of the boat. The insistence. I wouldn't have ever thought that a bag could be creepy. But there you go. You live and learn.
I'll have to sort it out later. No time now. I finish brushing my teeth, grab my bag, and dash for the jetty. I'll tell Mark later.
After the quick boat trip across the lagoon, we pile into an off-road vehicle. There are four of us, as well as the guide in the 4x4. Us and another young couple, Sally and Daniel. We set off. Snapshots of jungle. The edge of a Jeep wing mirror. Blurry smiling faces, hot black leather car seats against thighs. The smell of warm forest in the air. Wind along the hairs of my arm. Bumping hard over steep rugged hills. Cool air and warmth. And then we hike, the breeze reaching us over the treetops, shifting stones and dust underfoot, muffled chatter, sweat running down between my breasts, heavy breathing, Mark's darkening t-shirt ahead of me. By the end of our hike, I'm exhausted but satisfied, my legs heavy and loose. Mark's cheeks have picked up some sun, making him look irresistibly healthy, outdoorsy. I haven't seen him this happy for a while now. Old Mark. I can't stop touching him. His browning skin. On the boat trip back to the hotel, I rest one warm thigh over his. Territorial. I told him about the bag. He actually thought it was quite funny when I told him about it. Faulty towers funny. Hotel mishaps funny. I never really got faulty towers, to be honest. They always seem so angry, disproportionately angry. Maybe that's what's so funny, I don't know. Python, I love, but Cleese needs some tempering. Straight up Cleese is too rich for my blood. When we're back, we dive straight into bed, making lazy love and nap until sunset. Once we're showered and dressed, Mark leads me out onto the decking and pops a bottle of champagne. Eddie's champagne. Or, as I told Mark, Fred's champagne. He offers me a full glass, the fizz misting off its surface. You can tell a champagne's quality by the size of the bubbles. Did you know that? The smaller the bubbles, the more there are available to release the aroma and flavor. The carbon dioxide bubbles pick up and carry the flavor molecules, and the more there are, the more refreshing and subtle the flavors will feel to your palate. My glass is alive with long strings of tiny ascending bubbles. We clink. Marrying you was the best decision I ever made, he smiles. I just want you to know that I love you, Erin, and I'm going to look after you, and when we get home, I'm going to get another job, and we're going to make a proper life together. Sound good? Yes. That sounds perfect, I reply. I take a sip, the bubbles bursting over my lip and nose. It's heaven. I smile. Thank you, Eddie. What should we do about... I nod my head back towards the suite. He grins. I'll take it to the dive center tomorrow and give the dive coordinator the area location. He can deal with it. Or maybe he'll just put it back in our room, of course. Either way... He laughs. Music starts across the lagoon. On Sunday nights, there's a traditional Polynesian dinner show on the beach. I said to Mark, it does sound a little like 80s dinner theatre, but he reminded me this is the Four Seasons, so it's a 5-star, 3-course meal on a torchlit tropical beach, followed by traditional Polynesian water drumming and fire dancing. Right, like dinner theatre, I say. They do that in dinner theatre, right? We're seated at a table right at the water's edge. There are only 10 other couples, spaced out across the sand, lit by candles and flaming torches all along the water's edge. We give the couple from the hike a wave, Daniel and Sally. They smile and wave back, everyone loose-limbed and happy. The scent of Tahitian gardenia and fire fills the air. We sip more champagne and talk about the future. What we'll do once we're home. I tell Mark all about Alexa, her plan to get pregnant. I tell him about Holly, everything. I don't mention too much about Eddie, of course, or Eddie's gift. Mark listens, rapt. I think he forgot somehow that I was still living my life while he was so wrapped up in his, but he's interested now. He asks why they're letting Holly out at all. He asks if I think Alexa regrets what she did. We talk into dessert and through coffee, and then the show begins. Polynesian dancers, male and female, dressed in traditional costumes, flip and somersault across the sand with flaming torches clasped in bronzed hands or between clenched teeth, leaping into the air, diving into the water. Percussionists stand knee-deep in the waves and beat floating drums and the water with open palms. The music builds, builds, and climaxes with the waves flashing on fire for a moment in front of us, a circle of white-hot flames licking up off the surface of the water. And then darkness, claps and whoops. We move to the bar afterwards and on to cocktails. We dance, we talk, we kiss, we canoodle, we drink some more, and not until we're the last one standing do we call it a night, and stumble back along the jetty to our room. And there it sits, waiting. I get some nail scissors from the bathroom and we open it. Chapter 14. Monday, September the 12th. Flotsam or Jetsam. I wake up late. Mark is out cold beside me, the smell of booze thick over us. We forgot to order breakfast, or even turn the air conditioner on before we fell into bed last night. My head is fuzzy, and I'm hungry. It looks like we ordered more room service last night. I roll out of bed carefully and wander over to the abandoned trolley. Melted ice cream and an upturned champagne bottle in a bucket. How much did we drink? Jesus. My tongue feels fat and dry in my mouth. And I'm absolutely starving. I make an executive decision and head for the phone. Halfway across the floor, I feel a sharp pain shoot up through my foot and I lose my balance, crashing down hard on the stone tiles. Fucking hell! Ow, ow, ow! Fucking ow! A bright bulb of blood blossoms on the arch of my foot. Fuck. I see the offending scissors kicked up next to me. The bulb of blood bursts into a dribble and runs down and drips to the floor. My head throbs. Oh, fuck this. I stand slowly, cautiously, and hobble to the phone. They pick up after two rings. Hi there, can I order some room service, please? Yes, that's it. Yes. Can I get two full breakfasts? Poached. Coffee for two. Pastry basket. Yes, yes, that one. Orange juice for two. And do you have plasters? No. Plasters? Band-aids? No. Band... like a first aid kit or... Oh, yes. Yes, that's great. Yes, great. Thank you. I hang up and collapse back into bed, my foot bleeding into the sheets. Mark stares next to me. He grunts. 20 minutes, I mumble, and fall asleep. I wake as Mark pulls the breakfast trolley through the room and out onto the deck. He's wrapped in a hotel robe, bright white against his tan skin. I grab the first aid kit they brought and limp out to join him. Oversized t-shirt covering my underwear, foot crusted over with dried blood. We eat in silence, staring dazed into the middle distance. I hobble back in to fetch us painkillers. Then after putting a plaster over my injury, I make the short move across to a sun lounger and promptly fall asleep again. When I wake, I see Mark has pulled the sunshade over me. God, I love him. I test my head with a gentle nod, a gentle shake. Yes, better. Much better. Maybe a shower now. I hobble back into the room, past Mark watching Attenborough on cable, and into the bathroom. He blows me a kiss as I pass. I let the cool water run over my face and hair. I rub the shampoo deep into my scalp. The massage feels heavenly. I think about last night. What did we do once we got back? I don't remember having ice cream. I remember the scissors. Getting the scissors for the bag. That's it. I wrap a fresh towel around myself and wander back into Mark. Did we open it? I ask. I really hope we didn't. There's no way we can hand it in if we ruined it. He grimaces and hauls the bag up onto the bed. It's very clearly got a hole in it. We really didn't get very far last night. God, drunk people are idiots. I notice Mark's hand has two of the band-aids stuck to it. I guess he was in charge of the scissors last night. I sit down on the bed and inspect the bag. The hole is useless. I can't get a finger in to stretch it wider, and I can't see anything through it. Maximum impact, minimum results. Can we still hand it in? I look up at Mark. Yeah, of course. We'll just say we found it that way. It was in the sea, right? He doesn't seem concerned. If this hole is passable, would a slightly bigger hole be passable? I hold his gaze. He shrugs and chucks me the scissors from his bedside table. Knock yourself out, he says, his attention drifting back to Attenborough. But I don't. I'm scared. I don't know why. It seems wrong to open the bag. But why? It's just like finding a wallet, isn't it? It's all right to open the wallet and look at the stuff, find out who it belongs to. It's only not all right if you take the stuff inside it. I don't want to take the stuff inside it. I just want to know. And that's absolutely fine. It might help us return it, if we know whose it is. So I take the scissors to the bag again and start to cut. After a while, I wander out to the deck with it. There was a sharp knife out there on the food trolley earlier. I find it and force it into the small opening that I've already made and start to saw. Inside, I hear Mark turn on the shower. I keep sawing until I can get one hand into the hole. And then I pull with all my strength, opening the tear in the fabric. The canvas rips apart with a long, satisfying, bassy tear. I'm in. I turn to shout to Mark, but he's in the shower. Should I wait before I look? No. I tip the bag out onto the wooden decking and look down at its contents. I blink. A long time passes. I think about calling to Mark, but I don't. I just look. Four objects. The largest by far is the one I reach out for first. It's bulky, but much lighter than its size would suggest. This was what was keeping the bag afloat. Paper. Tightly packed paper. More specifically, paper money. A clear plastic vacuum-sealed package of money. American dollars. In bundles. Each bundle labeled $10,000 with a paper currency strap. Real money. Actual, real money. Lots of it. It hits me. Viscerally. My stomach flips and I run towards the bathroom, but impeded by the sharp stabs in my foot, I find myself vomiting halfway through my dash across the room. I lurch to my knees, bracing against the floor as my stomach muscles heave beyond my control. Bile. Thick, pungent bile. Fear made visible. I moan as I struggle to catch my breath between retches. We shouldn't have opened the bag. I wipe my mouth on the bedsheet and stumble to my feet. I limp back outside and squat down in front of it. I stare at the money. The tight vacuum packing has somehow managed to keep the water out. And although, obviously, that wasn't its original purpose, I doubt if we'd ever have found the duffel bag otherwise. The next item is a cloudy Ziploc bag, about the size of an iPad mini. It's full of small pieces of something. Something broken, maybe broken glass? The salt water has gone into this bag and misted the plastic, so I can't quite make out what's inside it. I run back into the room and grab a towel. I squat back down and rub at the plastic, but the fogginess is inside as well. I grab the scissors again and snip the corner of the baggie carefully. I tip the contents out onto the towel. Diamonds tumble out before me, beautifully cut and sparkling back at me in the sunlight. So many. I can't judge the number. 100? 200? They twinkle innocently in the sunlight. Mainly princess and marquis cut by the look of it. But I see some heart and pear cut in there too. I know my cuts, colors, and sizes of diamond. We looked at every possible permutation before Mark and I settled on the one in my ring. I look at my hand, my own ring glittering in the sunlight. They're all about the same size as my stone. That means they're all about 2 carats. Oh my God. I look down at the beautiful, sparkling pile, my breath catching in my throat, the sun glinting colors off of them. There could be over £1 million in diamonds here. Oh, wow. Wow, wow, holy crap. Mark! I call, slightly off key, slightly too loud. Mark? Mark, Mark, Mark? My voice sounds weird. I hear it coming for me, but I don't recognize it. I'm standing now. He runs out of the bathroom, bare-chested. My arm goes up and I point at the pile before me. His eyes follow my finger, but he can't see past the crumpled empty bag on the decking. Oh, watch out for the vomit, I shout. He dodges it and stares at me like I've gone insane, finally coming out to me in the sunshine, completely confused. What the? Then he sees it. Oh, Jesus Christ. Bloody hell. Right. Bloody. Okay, Christ. He stares at me. I can read his face as clear as day. Jesus. He's squatting down in front of it all, turning the packet of money over and over in his arms. He looks up at me. It could be $1 million. They're $10,000 packs, he says, his eyes bright. He's really excited. Because, let's be clear, this is really bloody exciting. I know, that's what I thought. What about the other stuff? I say quickly. I squat down beside him. He pushes the diamonds around on the towel with his finger. He moistens his lips and squints through the sun at me. 2 carats, right? That what you're thinking? He says. Yes. How many stones? Hard to tell without counting. I'm guessing 150 to 200. I nod. That's what I thought. So maybe $1 million's worth? Yeah, it could be more, but that seems right. Fuck. He rubs the stubble along his jaw. What else is there? He asks. I don't know, I haven't looked at the rest yet. He picks up another sealed clear plastic bag. Just visible through the salt smears is a USB stick. Sealed tight, somehow still protected from the water. He places it back down carefully next to the stones and the money. He looks at me before picking up the final object. It's a hard plastic case with a handle. He sets it down in front of us. I know what it is before he flips open the plastic latches. It sits there, dark, dense metal nestled in molded foam padding. A handgun. I don't know what type. I don't know about guns. The sort you'd see in a film, I guess. A modern film? That type. But a real one. On the decking, in front of us. Spare bullets nestled in a fresh cardboard box next to it in the foam, sealed. There's an iPhone in the box too. The plastic gun case must be airtight, because everything inside is dry, and I'd imagine still in working order. Okay. Mark closes the case. Let's go inside for a bit, shall we? He gathers the money, USB, the gun case into the destroyed canvas bag and ushers me inside. I carefully carry in the towel of diamonds. He slides the glass door shut and sets the bag on the bed. Okay, Erin, first things first. We're going to clean up the vomit, right? Clean ourselves and the room up. And then we're going to have a chat. Okay? He's watching me, encouraging me. He's speaking to me in the same even, measured tone he had yesterday when he told me about the sharks. He's extremely reassuring when he needs to be. Yes, I'll clean up. It doesn't take me long. I use some of the disinfectant lotion from the first aid kit to douse the floor. I wash my face, brush my teeth, and pull myself together. Meanwhile, Mark's cleaned the rest of the room. The food cart is gone. The bed is stripped now, too. The bag, the only thing on it. The diamonds sit in a whiskey tumbler. Mark wanders in from the lounge area, holding my laptop. First of all, I don't think we should contact the police until we know what the fuck is going on. I don't fancy spending life in a Polynesian prison for diamond smuggling or whatever. I suppose we need to know if anyone is missing this stuff, right? If anyone might know we have it, he says. I take the computer as he holds it out to me. I see. We're going to do a bit of research. Research I'm good at. He sits down on the bed and I sidle next to him. So, what should I check the news for? What do we think? Shipwreck? Missing persons? Or maybe robbery gone wrong? What are we looking for? I ask. I'm not sure. My fingers hover over the keys. We need something to go on. He looks at the bag again. Well, we have a phone. He lets it hang there. Yes. Yes, we do have a phone, which means we have a number. We also probably have an email address and emails, and we probably have an actual name. Shall I check the phone? See who they are? I ask. Not yet. Wait. Let's think logically here. Carefully. Are we breaking the law right now? Are we, Erin? Have we done anything? Anything at all wrong so far? Like I would know. I suppose my moral compass has always been slightly more true than his, but only slightly. No. No, I don't think so, I say. I ripped the bag, but I ripped it to find out what was inside, to find out who it belonged to. It's the truth, it should stand up. Why didn't we give it straight to the police or security? We did. We handed it in to the hotel straight away, but they gave it back to us. And then we got drunk, and we thought we'd sort it out ourselves. It's stupid, but it's not illegal. I nod. That sounds all right, I decide. But this is wrong now, I add. I say it as I think it. We should call the police right now and tell them about it. The gun and the money are definitely red flags, I say, nodding again. I study the frayed bag. I can see the corner of the packet of money through the torn canvas. $1 million. I look at Mark. Just a second, I say. I remember this. It came up in that Norwegian fisherman film. I tap away at Google. Basically, flotsam and jetsam, maritime debris, salvage, whatever you want to call it, basically treasure, is covered by international maritime law. Here, look at this. I scroll down and read from the Gov UK website. Jetsam is the term used to describe goods jettisoned overboard to lighten a vessel's load in emergencies. Flotsam is the term used to describe goods accidentally lost overboard in emergencies. Blah, blah, blah. The salver must declare salvaged goods by completing a report of salvage form within 28 days of recovery. Blah, blah, blah. A salver acting within the law is likely to be entitled to the salvaged goods should the owner not come forward. Aha. Oh, wait, shit. Under the Merchant Shipping Act of 1995, this law applies to all salvage within UK territorial waters, up to the 12 nautical mile limit. British law is totally irrelevant here. I'm not sure whether we fall under French or US law in Polynesia. I search again, tapping. Mark stares at the bag, mute. Here we go. US Department of Commerce. Flotsam and jetsam are terms that describe two types of marine debris associated with vessels. Flotsam is defined as debris in the water that is not deliberately thrown overboard, often as a result from a shipwreck or accident. Jetsam describes debris deliberately thrown overboard by a crew of a ship in distress, most often to lighten the ship's load. Under maritime law, the distinction is important. I look up at Mark. Flotsam may be claimed by the original owner, whereas jetsam may be claimed as property of whoever discovers it. If the jetsam is valuable, the discoverer may collect proceeds received through the sale of the salvaged objects.
I stop. Mark looks out of the window across the lagoon, frowning. When he finally speaks, he says, "So I suppose the question is this flotsam or jetsam?"
"Uh-huh,"
I nod, moistening my lips. "We need to go back there and find out. We need to go back to the paper circle tomorrow and see if there's a wreck. If the owner went down in the storm and lost this bag, that's one thing. If he threw it overboard and ran away, that's another. If there's nothing there, under the water, under those papers, then we are 2 million richer. If there's a wreck there, we'll just put the bag back, and then we'll report it. But if there's nothing there, if the bag was abandoned, I think we're all right. I think we'll be all right, Mark." I go to the fridge and grab some ice-cold water. I take a sip and pass it to him. "Yes?" I ask. He takes a sip, runs his hand through his hair.
"Yes," he agrees. "We'll go back tomorrow."
Chapter 15, Tuesday, September the 13th, A Dot in the Sea. Mark logs the coordinates into the GPS and we head off. It's another perfect day, deep azure above and below as far as the eye can see. Last night I googled news stories about the storm. There's no mention of any missing yachts or missing people. Nothing but holidaymakers' Instagram photos of storm clouds and wind-battered trees. As the waves fly by on the way there, I think of the ghost ship, the night of the storm. It was anchored there the whole time, wasn't it? Could that have been them? Did they leave during the storm? Why would they set sail in the middle of a storm? People don't do things like that. Yachts have names. Their movements are logged. I'm sure we'd have heard by now if a ship was missing, wouldn't we? But there's nothing online. No mention of a missing ship. Who are we kidding? The bag didn't come off that little holiday yacht. The circle of paper in the water. The diamonds, the vacuum-packed money, the phone, the gun. I'm pretty sure that whoever owns this bag isn't in the habit of logging their movements. Whoever they are, I don't think they'll have left a convenient trail for us to find. I have the feeling of being too near to something I don't want to be near to something dangerous. I can't quite see what it is yet, but I feel it. It feels close. I feel the trapdoors in my mind creaking under the strain of what lies beneath. But then, of course, it could just be free money, and everyone loves free money. Somebody might have made a mistake, and if it doesn't hurt anyone, then we could keep it. Free money for us, and it's not like we don't need it. It only takes us 50 minutes to reach the spot today. Something to do with tidal stream and drift, Mark says. I'm not really listening. When we arrive, there's nothing left of the paper circle. Nothing to say anything was ever here. Nothing but water for miles. If Mark hadn't written down the coordinates on Saturday, we'd never have found this place again. Ever since Mark suggested the idea of diving to look for a wreck, I've had a dreadful feeling lurking just below my thoughts. I really don't want to find a boat. I really, really don't. But more than that, the thought that I'm pushing down hardest is that we'll find something else. That it won't be sharks hanging heavy in the water this time. It'll be something different. Something worse. He can feel my tension. We rig up in silence, Mark throwing me reassuring glances. He thinks it'll be about 40 meters deep here. Contextually speaking, that's 2 meters higher than the statue of Christ the Redeemer in Rio. I can only really go to 20, and he knows it. But the visibility out here is damn near perfect, so we should be able to see right to the bottom without moving a muscle, or at least without having to go all the way down. Before we slip into the water, Mark warns me again about the sharks. It doesn't seem that relevant today. I stare off into the cloudless sky, letting his words wash over me. I breathe, trying to let his voice calm me. We're both nervous, and it's not about sharks. I notice I'm shaking when we do our buddy check in the water. He grasps my hand and holds it tight against his chest for a second. My heart rate slows. The waves are big and rolling as high today. There's a strong breeze, but Mark promises it'll be placid once we're underwater.